Good morning and welcome to the Talkies. We've all heard the climate reports. We've got 12 years to transition from a carbon-based economy to an economy based on clean energy. But how do we do that? Well, last year, in 2018, momentum started building around a Green New Deal. There was a sit-in at the Capitol, there were mobilizations at representatives' offices across the country, another sit-in at the Capitol. So today, we're going to talk to the organizers behind the effort for living wage green jobs. I'm your host, Carla West, filling in for Chris Welch, and I'm joined in studio by Isaac Silk. He's an organizer with the Sunrise Movement Bay Area Chapter. Welcome, Isaac.
Thanks for having me.
Megan Zapanta is the Richmond Organizing Director from the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Martha Hawthorne is a musician, organizer, and union activist with Service Employees International Union, Local 10 to 1. Welcome, Martha.
Thank you.
So, Isaac, can you tell us what's wrong with the climate?
Well, thanks so much for having me again, Carla. What's wrong with the climate? Nothing inherently is wrong with the climate other than the fact that we have far too many fossil fuels, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide in the air. So we are currently at a level of 1 to 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming, which is clearly already unsafe. There's a million people, according to the World Health Organization, already dying just from air pollution unrelated to the effects of global warming. We're seeing sea level rise, hurricanes, wildfires happening at a higher incidence. And we're, according to scientists, on a trajectory for 3 to 6 or 7 degrees warming within the century. And that doesn't show any signs of stopping. Global emissions are on the rise again after a brief flattening of the rate in 2015 and 2016. And emissions in America are also rising despite the continuing phase out of coal plants, as the news said today. So the climate situation is, I would characterize it as rapidly deteriorating, and there is hasn't been a very effective solutions put into place yet to actually address the root causes of global warming in various sectors across global economy, including electricity generation, agriculture, transportation, et cetera, et cetera. So we have a lot of work to do before 2030. And yeah, that's how I would characterize it.
Okay, thank you. So we have a lot of work to do before 2030. And I know that Martha and Megan are both part of organizations that have been doing a lot of work on this. Since before the Green New Deal, this recent iteration of the Green New Deal got momentum. So I wanted to start there to have you describe some of the work you've been doing. How about you, Martha? Would you like to tell us some of what the labor movement has been doing, working on creating sustainable living wage jobs?
Sure. Thank you for being here. And I'm really glad we have a whole hour to delve into this, because there are the problems are so great and there's so much to be done. You know, in the labor movement, union workers have been involved for so long in the struggle for good jobs and for a clean environment. I mean, we go back to the New Deal in the 30s that could not have happened without labor. The Civilian Conservation Corps, for example, planted tens of thousands of trees. During that New Deal, worker rights took a huge leap forward, and we gained the right to collectively bargain, the right to strike, and the right to organize on the job. So since then, those rights are being eroded in many ways. Now, we've had moments of true inspiration in the 70s. I remember, I wasn't yet a union member, but hearing about Karen Silkwood and Tony Mazzocchi with the oil, chemical, atomic workers talking about the dangers of nuclear industry for workers and for the public. For Pam Tao Lee, Jose Brava in Richmond, who really coined, I believe, the term just transition. And these people have been so inspirational to me. I'm the daughter of a petroleum engineer. I was a waitress for 10 years, worked in Local 2 around union issues as a shop steward, and then became a public worker with SEIU as a nurse. And that taught me the value of public workers, first responders, the health that all of us in the public sector try to guarantee the public and all the barriers we encounter. I worked years trying to preserve public services and public health. And then 3 years ago, delved into the issue of climate and unionism by being involved in the efforts trying to divest our pension funds from fossil fuels. I founded the Climate Committee in SEIU 10 to 1. We've, in 3 years, accomplished a lot. We've signed on to Brown's Last Chance, calling into question fracking on a global level, on the level of California and our own Bay Area. And I was proud that SEIU 10 to 1 was the first union to endorse the climate march on September 8th, Climate Rise for Jobs and Justice. And we were able to gain the support of over 50 unions and labor centers in promoting this march. And as we understand the urgency for all workers, for all our communities and all our families, we want a just transition and we want it fast. So we've stood on the shoulder of the union movement that is no longer in decline. And I'm happy that this broad coalition represents another ray of hope in these dismal times.
Thank you very much. And Megan, you know, Asian Pacific Environmental Network has been working on pollution in your community and working on living wage jobs for a long time. Can you tell us a little bit about what your organization has been working on?
Yeah. So the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, or APEN, has actually been doing this work organizing Asian immigrant and refugee communities in Oakland and Richmond for most of my lifetime, the last 25 years. Martha brought up Pam Tao Lee, who is one of our founders and a real hero of mine personally. And so we have a really rich history of organizing in immigrant communities. And I specifically work in Richmond. And so our base in Richmond is historically the Laotian refugee community. So these are, you know, poor and working folks who were forced over to move here from Laos, were looking to start a new life here, didn't know what to expect when they moved to Richmond, didn't realize they were settling like next to this huge oil refinery, and really learned to make home in this new place. And so for our members, you know, a lot of the work has taken different forms over the last 25 years, but it's really trying to think about, you know, think with the community and create this just transition with the community. And it's not just looking at limiting pollution, because that's, you know, a huge part. And when you talk to our members, that's one of their first issues. It's always like the health issues. It's always the pollution. But there's a whole host of other things, including thinking about healthcare, thinking about education, healthy access to healthy food, building a local economy that really benefits people, where there's really thriving jobs and people can stay and invest in the community. And then also we've been working, you know, we also have a history in both Oakland and Richmond in fighting for housing rights, because, you know, for our communities, we don't want to just clean up Richmond, clean up Oakland, clean up these neighborhoods so that the next people who move there get to have a beautiful place to live. For us, we really want to see the people that are living there that have built history and home and created that change to be the ones to benefit from it in the future.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. And so, Isaac, now can you tell us a little bit about what is the Green New Deal? Can you tell us?
Sure. Yeah. And it's so awesome to be here with some other organizers that have been working in organizations that have been around for so long doing this work and really laying the groundwork for Sunrise, which is basically just a baby organization. I think it's a year and a half old, made up out of the student fossil fuel divestment movement and other student movements to keep fossil fuels in the ground. And as such, I mean, only starting in 2017, the Green New Deal concept, we would never claim to take 100% credit for that at all. It's this concept of thinking through how do you rapidly transform a society in order to make it into one that is livable for the future, that isn't putting our future generations' lives at risks and protecting the environment in a sustainable way for both social, racial justice and for workers' rights is something that people have been thinking about for a long time. I know that Jill Stein had it as part of her party plank in 2008. And there's been a talk looking back to the World War II era as inspiration for how to transform a society very rapidly for an existential threat to fight against an existential threat. And obviously there were huge mistakes made in that period of time, as we know, in the Bay Area. Japanese internment is the salient example of the huge mistakes that can be made. So this idea of community control and local reinvestment is so huge and important. But the Green New Deal, to get back to your original question, as we envision it, is a plan to rapidly transition all sectors of the economy off of fossil fuels and into a regenerative system that provides for workers that will be transitioned out of jobs and give a job guarantee to workers who want to be involved in the clean economy. And also that promises to respect the equity considerations for past fossil fuel extraction. So we know that the vast majority of people that suffer at the hands of pollution from fossil fuel sources are people of color living in marginalized communities. As Americans, we know that we've benefited the most from the fossil economy and that people in the global south are the people who are facing the most serious impacts of it right now. So there's a reason that Pacific Islanders were fighting so hard for the 1.5 degree number in the Paris Climate Accords. And that's because basically at 1.5 degrees, that's not even a safe level for those island nations. That is 2 degrees is essentially dooming the entire continent of Africa to not being able to survive. And we're on a pathway to 3 degrees. So this extends from equity in our local communities, places where extraction is happening and processing of fossil fuels here in Richmond, and asthma rates are extremely high. And it extends all the way to the global south where people are feeling impacts. So as Americans, I think it's our duty to come together and try and make this transition happen as rapidly as possible and make the technology available to people around the world in order to pay our debt, essentially.
And could you just give us a little mini on, for people who don't know what Sunrise Movement is, could you just tell us briefly what it is? So it's a youth movement. And how did you get started? And can you just tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Yeah. I think Sunrise is a youth movement started by people all under the age of 30 who recognized that young people needed a voice in the electoral process and that climate needed to be a much larger part of the conversation for our elected officials. So we're calling for Democratic politicians especially to say no to fossil fuel money and to also step up on climate or step aside. So the Sunrise Movement comes out of the world of pipeline protests and fossil fuel divestment and with a serious focus on electoral politics.
Okay. And now back to the Green New Deal. Can you tell us just what some of the tenets of the Green New Deal are, or what are a few of the points?
Sure. So what we would like to see is the Democratic Party create a select committee that has a mandate to create a plan for the rapid and just transition of all sectors of the economy towards decarbonization within the next 12 years. That's a plan that would be based in scientific reality, not in the, not so legit science of political feasibility. And the tenets would be based in community control of community oversight, listening to frontline communities in these decisions that are being made policy-wise, as well as protecting the rights of workers, pensions of workers and industries that may have to be phased out, and the holding firm to the belief that folks who are looking to get jobs in the clean economy will be provided with those jobs. What the specifics of that plan look like, that's what we're hoping that are not paid for by fossil fuel industries, politicians will be hammering out the details on. But we want to hold firm to those, the idea of this rapid, just transition, which our activist forebears have been talking about for some time now. So that would be the basic tenets.
Okay, thank you. And can you tell us a little bit about the movement behind it and how it got started and how it's been moving?
Sure. Yeah. So Sunrise is a distributed group of hubs of youth groups around the country that have some autonomy to make their own decisions about what they're interested in, what campaigns they want to do, who they would like to endorse, how they want to use their people power resources to try and make real climate solutions a priority for elected officials. So there is a national hub that gets a lot of attention because they've done such incredible organizing in DC and doing sit-ins in the Capitol building and working together with congresspeople like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But there are groups all around the country that are working to convince their elected officials that climate change should be a priority. There's Sunrise is going on tour this coming year to 14 or 15 different cities to talk about climate change and try and bring this issue outside of the Beltway, outside of the coasts, and make it a priority for politicians all across the country.
Okay, thanks. And now, Martha, I'd like to come back to you. Now, Labor has been involved in working on writing the Green New Deal. And can you tell us a little bit about your involvement and what things were important to Labor to have as part of the Green New Deal?
Sure. The Green New Deal has the potential to re-energize and inspire the labor movement at this moment in time. And that's really exciting. Now, among public workers, my union, 60,000 members in Northern California, were some of the lowest paid union members and some of the people and the families suffering the most from climate. We had 300, 400 union members all told lose homes in the fires. We have first responders, not in my union, but in other unions who have lost their lives. And I think the climate crisis is starting to come home to many of our members. However, we've got the crisis of affordability. We've got unprecedented wealth and unprecedented poverty, especially where I live in San Francisco, all over the Bay Area. So that's a challenge to say to a union member, we've got 12 years to get this economy on track to save ourselves. They're like, well, yeah, I need my paycheck for tomorrow. I have to pay my rent. Our mission, really, in SEIU is to lift up the lowest paid workers. We have proposals for the common good, campaigns like the Fight for 15, which raise not only our members, but hopefully all workers. Now, to link these struggles against really corporate greed and the profit system is the opportunity that I feel the Green New Deal can offer the labor movement. It's really not easy, but it's got the potential to start and to continue important discussions among all of us organizations that care about our future. So when I heard about the Green New Deal, I'm a member of Labor Network for Sustainability. We had a webinar talking about what labor needs from the Green New Deal to get traction from our members to make it believable. And one of the things was the right to organize. A just transition to a job that's got lower pay with no rights is not really a transition our members are interested in. And again, we raise the boat for everyone when we insist on the right to organize. And I was pleased that Sunrise did take this seriously and incorporate it into some of the text. Now, this is a moving target. This is a document. I'm hoping that it is really inclusive in a lot of our wants and needs to continue and to build a real coalition that can bring this change. So not just the right to organize, But union jobs, vulnerable communities, people who have never had jobs, need a just transition to, and also calling into a question the military-industrial complex, which is defending fossil fuels. Now, this is a big lift. It's huge. But unless we bring all these components into our struggle, we can't win. So in our union, we're beginning this discussion, and in the coalition Labor Rise, who got together around the climate march, we are starting these difficult discussions.
Thank you. And we were just listening to Martha Hawthorne. You're a musician, organizer, and union activist with Service Employees International Union, Local 10 to 1. And I'm Carla West, filling in for Chris Welch, hosting the talkies. We're also talking with Isaac Silk, who's an organizer with the Sunrise Movement Bay Area Chapter, and Megan Zapanta, Richmond Organizing Director from the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. So now, Megan, I would like to ask you, what are some things that are important to the communities that you work with as far as moving forward with something like a Green New Deal? What things are important, or what would you like to see make sure is part of it?
Yeah. And first of all, I want to say that the Green New Deal, it's amazing to have a national platform that's linking climate change and economic inequality. Because, I mean, I think something that for all of us in the room that we've all been thinking about for a long time is that it's the same wealthy few that are profiting at everyone's expense that are polluting and making us all sick and making the climate sick. And so really thinking about a different approach to climate change that integrates economic inequality is a very important way of shifting the national dialogue around climate change. I think there is a danger a little bit in replacing a dirty, polluting economy that's only benefiting a wealthy few with creating a clean, renewable energy economy that's still only benefiting a wealthy few. And so for us, I think when we think about what do we want to see in an overall transition, what do we want to see in a Green New Deal for it to feel really real and genuine to our communities, we would need to see a different type of intervention where people, families, workers, people on the ground are really part of shaping what policies get passed and really benefiting from them. And I think another important piece for us is around the different mechanisms for how you cut carbon. And so, we're already seeing in California where there's cap and trade, which is this false market-based solution to cutting carbon. And it means that corporations like Chevron are able to continue polluting in our neighborhoods, but pay more. And so
Jump in with just a quick little story there? At one of the hearings in Richmond on Chevron, I remember community members were getting up and giving testimony. Mm-hmm. And one man, it was in relation to what you're talking about. He said, I think the argument of Chevron was that the pollution wasn't, they claimed they didn't increase the pollution overall.
Yeah.
And he said, and however many hundred thousand other people, he said, we don't live in a town called Overall. We live in a town called Richmond.
Yeah.
And what matters to us is the pollution in Richmond, not whether you're trading it with some pollution somewhere else. Anyway, it was just a really good point the way he made that. Anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's really thinking about how do we take the places that the fossil fuel industry has turned into sacrifice zones, has decided like the people living here can get sick, can die. And you can talk to our members, and there's just so many people have been sick from different things. And it's like, how do we actually think about those places first and foremost in actually centering policies and cutting carbon at the source, cutting pollution at the source? And so for us, like for whatever policy moves forward, it's both having those people be making the decisions, really be the protagonist in changing and transforming the structure. But it's also making sure that we're not turning to the same green tech, false solutions, salvations, and we're not relying on market-based mechanisms to make the change for us, because we know it has to be a structure that's entirely different from what we've seen before.
Thank you. I just wanted to let folks know that in a little while, we'll be opening up the phone lines and opening it up to your questions and comments. So I just wanted to give out the number so you can get ready to call in if you have a question or a comment for one of the guests. So the number is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008, or locally 510-848-4425. That's 510-848-4425. And Isaac, it looked like you had something you wanted to say.
Well, I just wanted to echo what Megan was saying. I think there's a reason later this year we'll be hearing a lot about this carbon tax, for lack of a better word, bill that's going to be coming forward. And the fossil fuel industry is going to be putting their own version of a carbon tax forward. And there's a reason that they want to do that and use a market-based solution. Now, obviously, theirs is going to be a watered-down version of the one that's being put forward by Citizens Climate Lobby. But they want to be allowed to pollute for as long as possible. And these market-based solutions are, when they're untethered from any other solutions, they can be used to allow them to continue to burn fossil fuels for longer and longer and pollute communities. And they want to do that as long as possible so that they can continue to move into the renewable space, because they see the writing on the wall. We need to make sure that in any solutions, we're making that sure that communities have control over where their electricity is coming from, and have control over how their communities are developed. And so it's pretty incredible to see in the Bay Area how these national issues that we think about on a sort of, you know, federal scale are actually playing out in our communities here in terms of the completely unequal distribution of the effects of climate change. I mean, as we saw recently in the fires, the housing crisis caused there to be more people living on the streets. And those are the people that are suffering the most from living in 12 to 14 days worth of toxic air. And there was not a system for getting those people into safe spaces, getting them the help that they needed in a comprehensive way. So it's clear that we're radically unprepared at the local level to be dealing with the effects of climate change, but we're also seeing the effects of climate change happening to our communities, and they have been for decades.
And can you tell us a little bit about specifically what's been going on so far in the movement to support the Green New Deal? Like, can you tell us how you've been organizing or some of the demonstrations and actions?
Yeah, I think Sunrise has taken inspiration from the past civil rights struggles and saw that, you know, sitting in and saying that you're willing to put your body on the line to get arrested in order to put your convictions in front of elected officials and make sure that they recognize that young people want to have a livable future. We want to have the right to have families in the future and not have to have massive anxiety about what our children's world is going to look like. So we've found that to be an extremely effective organizing tool, is to sit down in the offices of elected officials and force them to have a truthful conversation with us about what they think the future is going to look like and what we think the future is going to look like. Because from our perspective, it looks pretty grim. And we know that, in fact, the present, this very moment, things are looking very grim for people.
And so You had some of your members sat in at the Capitol, and then you also mobilized in representatives' offices across the country and then sat in at the Capitol again. Can you tell us a little bit about any of those actions?
Yeah, so the original action, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came and, you know, spoke, announced her plan for the Green New Deal. It got a lot of press coverage. We saw this sort of whirlwind moment take off. Then more people visited hundreds of representatives' offices around the country, reached out, tried to force Nancy Pelosi's hand in creating the Select Committee. She ultimately did not quite go as far as we were hoping for. She calls the committee a Select Committee on the Climate Crisis, which is good. It's easy to call it a climate crisis, but actually treating it as such is a whole different can of worms. So the proof is in the pudding. I think Kathy Castor, who's in charge of that committee, she has a big task ahead of her. There's a lot of competing constituencies that want her ear, from local communities all the way to fossil fuel billionaires. So I don't envy her job, although I think, you know, And I'm hoping that she does a good job with it. We'll see.
And so that that moves into sort of what I was going to ask you next, which is the future of the movement. But I wanted to, before we talk about that a little more, I wanted to let people know that you can call in. We are opening the phone lines. You can call in with your questions or comments. The phone number is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008. Or locally, you can call 510-848-4425. That's 510-848-4425. So, on the point of Nancy, so bottom line is, as part of the Green New Deal, you wanted to have a committee to look into what exactly is it stipulated?
Right. The committee we wanted would ban fossil fuel, ban any politician who has taken donations from fossil fuel industry executives. We didn't get that provision. We also wanted a mandate to craft a plan for a rapid and just transition over the course of the next 12 years. That mandate is not in the committee. And that's disappointing. But this is not a closed book. You know, I mean, oh, the other thing is that there also is no subpoena power in the committee, which is something that the last time this committee existed, they did have. So that's concerning. I mean, there are concerns up and down the board about this committee. But the good news is that because of the direct actions, climate change is on the forefront of Democratic Party politics moving towards 2020. So what we're focusing on is making sure that politicians know that for young people, for vulnerable communities, climate change and environmental justice are serious issues, and we're trying to instigate a race to the top for presidential candidates and for any elected official running for office in 2020. They need to know that in order to be a progressive politician, in order to lead the Democratic Party and to lead the quote-unquote left, you need to actually offer real solutions to the climate crisis, not false solutions. So I think that's what's so exciting about having Megan and Martha here, is that what we really need is not just a group of young people sitting in a congressional offices. We need a movement made up, an extremely diverse movement made up of people that have tons of experience organizing, of new organizers, bringing new people into this conversation, extending it beyond just the question of the environment, but really pointing out that this is a jobs issue. This is an economy issue. And yeah, I'm excited to have Martha and Megan here to talk more about, you know, what they envision for the movement, because that's what we need in order to really force the politician's hand.
So I wanted to give you two, Martha and Megan, a chance. Do you want to comment right now on what you see as the future of this movement? We also have some callers. We can get to those after if you want to comment before, or we could go right to the callers. It's up to you.
I can comment really quickly.
Okay, go ahead.
I think for me, just one of the things I was going to say, and it's like, what changes having this big platform out there? And, you know, in a lot of ways, nothing really changes for us in that, you know, like my day-to-day work is working with young Asian children of immigrants, other people of color who are growing up in Richmond, and really trying to educate them, get them involved, make them leaders in fighting for whatever kind of change that they need in their communities, and also working with our elders who are kind of the fiercest people I've ever met when it comes to fighting big polluters and taking on big oil again and again. And so for me, a lot of the way I'm thinking about it is, it's amazing to have this national discussion that's kind of catching up to where our families have been in terms of thinking about what kind of just transition we need, what kind of economy we need. And so for me, I continue to keep having these conversations and really trying to, really trying to continue to bring our leaders to be the protagonists in making this transformation.
Thanks.
I would just add that the key word is movement. Electoral politics are not going to change unless there's a huge movement pushing our leaders to do the right thing. And that's the exciting part of this moment. And if Labor does not start this discussion, a difficult discussion, we will be left behind.
Thanks, Martha. So now let's see, we have Greg in Palo Alto. Do you have a question or a comment for our guests?
Well, I guess both. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that the people in your panel are committed to this and really working hard to try and bring this about. I guess the question I have is, it doesn't seem to me that the sense of urgency that's required for the kind of changes that are going to take place or need to take place. It just seems to me, and I live down here in a city that's supposed to be progressive, where the environmental movement, as far as I'm concerned, is just almost a dead issue. So I don't know how that movement is going to be built. My sense is the 12-year issue that we've been given, I'm not sure how they arrived at that. I'm not sure we even have 12 years. And I'm just concerned about this, the fact that things may have to get even worse before people realize that if they don't do something about it, and it may be too late to do something about it. I'm not sure about that either. So I don't know if they have any ideas about the state of California. I would think maybe there's one thing that I would maybe suggest, and I'm sure they've thought about this. I just don't understand why the state of California hasn't passed a bill that would require all state and public buildings in the state of California to be solarized, that everywhere there's a public building, they have got to mount solar panels on that building to provide electricity. So I guess that's it for now. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Greg. And let's see.
I'll start. I feel a sense of urgency. That's why I'm here. And your caller, if you do too, you need to find other people that in your neighborhood that do feel the sense of urgency. I can say in San Francisco and all over the Bay Area, we breathed air that was really, really bad. We couldn't go outside. Those people that have money took vacations and got away from it with difficulty. But that's something that we have felt now in our own homes and in our own streets. I think the problem in California is the hold that the fossil fuel corporations have on our politicians, and that's what we have to work to get out. Now, we can have a Green New Deal at the local level, at the state level, at the national level. We need to be thinking of all these solutions.
Thank you. Does anybody else want to add anything before we
Yeah, I'd like to add. I think if you're talking to communities that have been living in sacrifice zones where they've just been polluting for years and years and years, there's a sense of urgency, especially, you know, if you talk to some of the refugee families that we work with, you're talking about grandmothers, and they'll talk about how they want to take down the railway tracks to keep toxic explosive materials from coming into their communities. They'll talk about how they want to physically dismantle the refinery tomorrow. And they've been telling us this for, you know, as long as I've worked at APEN, they've been telling me these things. And so I think there's a sense of urgency when you've been living in these conditions for a long time. And I think for other people, it's starting to catch up as we're all experiencing the fires, or we're all seeing these things more and more commonly. But it's really catching up to the people who've been on the front lines and talking about this for a long time. As to the solarizing public buildings, that's one of the things that, you know, when we asked our members, what are one of the big priorities you'd want to see for Richmond? And that was actually one of their big priorities, was they actually wanted to see the public buildings, at least in Richmond, be solarized. And Richmond's a city that has had a really good track record on being a front runner, you know, in terms of solar energy, in terms of working with a CCA, Marin Clean Energy, trying to do all these things that are moving in the right direction. But, you know, for us, we want to take that sense of we're doing great there, but we also want to push forward and really see publicly owned, publicly managed resources when it comes to energy.
Okay, thanks. That was Martha from local SEIU, local 10 to 1. And then just now, that was Megan from APEN. And now we will move to Leif, who's calling from Berkeley. Leif, do you have a question or a comment?
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I thought you said when you opened the program that you were going to talk about specific solutions. I may have misinterpreted. I think what we're having is a problem with managers. So I liked what the caller said the time before about what the state does. I'm surprised we don't have a federal, state, and local city town hall meetings about specifically what we can do in aggregate. because it's not about the oil companies, it's not about Chevron. It's about you and me and what we do. So specifically regarding the solar panels, I'm surprised. So what I was expecting to hear from your guests, and the reason why I'm calling, is specifically what type of businesses that install solar panels or do anything, plant trees or whatever be, that they're organized with, that they're expanding on, that we can join in to actually solve the problem ourselves. This is blatantly missing from all the conversations on any radio programs in any media about specifically what we're supposed to do. It's not up to the managers. It's not up to the city council because they're not doing anything. It's about what we specifically need to do ourselves. So I would like it if your guests could, guest hosts could talk specifically about specifically what jobs in a justice economy they have specific ideas with corporations or local entrepreneurs to actually solve the problem on the ground.
Okay, thanks, Leif. So, Martha, do you have an idea, like, what jobs do you think would be helping to solve the climate crisis?
Well, let's look back to the New Deal in the 30s. There were millions and millions of new jobs created, basically putting people back to work, building parks, planting trees, and actually building public transportation. That's something we could do. We could improve our public transportation. It's at a pathetic state at this point. On the other hand, San Francisco has good buses and some people don't ride them. People who can do and should. Some workers who have to, can't afford to live in the city have to drive their cars. So a better system of public transportation, for example, that would provide many jobs to build those tracks, to build those lines. Another example of something that's already been started is the Clean Power Initiative. In San Francisco, we have the option to sign up for clean 100% energy through the same system that PG&E provides. It's not the best, but it is something people can individually do, sign up for clean power. On the other hand, we have PG&E that is under fire and may go bankrupt for all their mismanagement and the corporate policies that have brought us actually more pollution. So I think there are individual things people can do, but there's also a system that makes it really hard for individuals to do any of these things.
Yeah, I would just add that I think actually the environmental movement has done a fairly good job of talking to people about their individual choices and not so good of a job about talking about how this is a collective action problem. So I think the powers that be would like us to think that all we need to do to deal with this problem is think about ourselves as atomized individuals and not think of ourselves as an interconnected, holistic community that relies on toxic extraction in environmental destruction zones that affect people that don't maybe look like the people that have all of the money, and asking those people to maybe spend $30,000 on an electric car and say that's enough. But we know that that's not enough. And I think most people out there now realize that their individual solutions are actually not amounting to the kind of change that we really need to see to essentially guarantee a livable future for people alive today and in future generations. So that's why we're talking about building a movement. Obviously, you can eat less meat. There are different ways of reducing your personal carbon footprint. There, you can go to 100% carbon-free or renewable energy through your local energy provider now in the Bay Area. So those are all incredible things that we know about because of organizers and activists, and those are options. But in order to see the true society-wide transition that we need to make sure that local people who have suffered the brunt of the effects of climate change are involved in the creation of policies that radically transform our entire society in the next decade. So that doesn't look like necessarily putting solar panels on your roof. It looks like getting the government to say solar panels are going on every roof. And those solar panels are actually going to be, people are going to be paid for the energy that they're creating, and that money that is being created from local energy generation is being reinvested in communities in the way that the community that's generating the electricity wants to see it reinvested.
Well, and ultimately, one of the big problems is that we live in a system of corporate control. And so we have to figure out a way of putting power in the hands of the people and taking it away from corporations that are only benefiting a few wealthy people who are getting rich off the backs of all of the rest of us, and think about how do we change the terms of labor, and whether that is, you know, empowering workers through union movements and making sure they're getting paid a living wage, or whether that is creating cooperative enterprises where people aren't in this structure and seeing themselves as employees in a certain way. But if we're thinking about how do we at all levels intervene in that system and put the hands back in the hands of people.
Thank you. And let's see, you're listening to The Talkies. We are talking about the Green New Deal today. We are joined by Megan Zapanta. She's Richmond Organizing Director from the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. Martha Hawthorne is a musician, organizer, and union activist with Service Employees International Union Local 10 to 1. And Isaac Silk is an organizer with Sunrise Movement's Bay Area Chapter. Our phone lines are open. They're actually full right now, but as soon as somebody jumps off, you'll be able to call 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008. So, David in Palo Alto, do you have a question or comment?
Yes. Hi, everybody. Excuse me. I wanted to give a shout out to Martha. She's the greatest, isn't she? And thank you to KPFA for doing this show about this important topic. One thing I wanted to remind people is about the talk with Antonio Yuhas and Dar Jamal on the 31st that KPFA is sponsoring. And I think if people are interested, they can get more information at the KPFA website. But the earlier callers and the guests were saying, people are suffering and dying, you know, as we speak because of all this pollution. So the more we get to work and start tackling this issue, the sooner the better. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. So I think we could go ahead and...
Thank you, David. He is a member of SEIU 10 to 1 on the Climate Justice Committee. I'm glad he's listening. And I, too, want to go hear Dar Jamal. That sounds like a great thing to do.
Oh, yeah. And thanks for the shout out, David. So anyone can go to kpfa.org and get more information about the KPFA events. And Antonia Yuhas is having a conversation with Dar Jamal. And I think that's on the 31st. So next we have Wendy in Berkeley. Wendy, do you have a question or a comment?
Yes. Well, first of all, I would just like to thank you all so much for your great efforts and the broadness and depth of your efforts that you're looking at the larger picture and looking at all the aspects. One thing I would like to add that I'm thinking of is the importance of looking at values in what, you know, in why the climate crisis arose, why are we using in such a why are we using so much petroleum so thoughtlessly? And I just feel like we have to step back, because not only is our values and not recognizing and the interrelatedness of life and respecting the non-human leading us to use that with so thoughtlessly, it's also a part of what's destroying, you know, why we're using pesticides, why we fished out the oceans, why in every aspect of the earth is being pressed down upon, is because we're not looking at that. And I think it's every time we speak about this, I don't think we can exclude the importance of opening up, because if we do develop renewable energies, we can't think now everything's good and we could just do whatever we want, you know, and make more things, everyone can have more cars because we're not using that. Actually, everything is affecting the earth, and it's not just for us we have to do it. It's we have to look outwardly and respect we're only a part. We're one of many human organisms, and we have to cultivate that respect. So I just want to, and love, actually. I want to just put a word in for that. So thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Wendy.
I was just going to say, I do think that it's a really important point that part of this regenerative economy that we're trying to make a just transition towards, it's really trying to get back into or create a new or some sort of new hybrid of what right relations look like with the earth, with each other. And that's part of, you know, why I think Indigenous communities have been so much at the forefront of environmental justice and climate justice movements. It's for me, like, working with Indigenous people from Southeast Asia who are forced out of their land, but they know how to be stewards of land. They know how to farm, how to like fish, how to live off the land, like actually work, like having visited Indigenous communities in the Philippines where they've actually faced all these typhoons and are facing some of the worst effects of climate change, like actually learning from those people where they know how to steward the land, they know how to survive these crises, and thinking about, yeah, obviously it's not, we've been living in this system of corporate control of capitalism that feeds off of endless profits that are going to a few wealthy people. And we have to actually really intervene in that system. And it's going to be a more radical change than something we can do overnight.
I'd like to add to that. One of the best things with the September 8th climate mobilization was working with Idle No More, Indians for Social Change, the Indigenous groups that came from around the world to tell their story and give us inspiration about how they have survived for centuries and centuries. And that if we say, oh, it feels kind of bad these days, they'll say, we've seen worse and we will survive.
Thank you. And now we have Andrew calling from Los Angeles. Andrew, do you have a question or comment?
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah. Greetings, Carla, and greetings to your guests. Thanks for the show. The youth have been incredibly impressive in their contribution to this issue of climate change and solutions and the effect it will have on them. So I'm wondering, I think they need to be, we need to continue to have them in these discussions, and they need to be represented in decision-making bodies. So I'm wondering if they have any representation on this new Green Deal committee that the Democrats are putting together, or of any other advisory or governmental bodies that are working on this issue. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Andrew.
Well, so yeah, thanks for your question, Andrew. I believe that they haven't decided who's on the select committee in the House as of right now. So we're really hoping that some of the, I don't know if you saw the photo of those incredible freshman House members, of the new people, women of color who are in the House, but we're really hoping that a bunch of, if not all of those, are on that select committee, because we know that they have incredibly good ideas on this issue. So we're excited about the freshman class in the House. I know that in Portland, Oregon, there is a youth climate advisory shadow council to the municipal government. But I think the caller brings up, Andrew brings up a good point, which is that youth voices are not being heard in a moment that is critical to their survival. So, for instance, Gavin Newsom's kids, I think his oldest daughter is 9 years old. That means by the time that the IPCC scientists say will be too late to have a significant impact on runaway global warming, she'll be, 20 years old? 21? So that's 4 years away from being able to run for Congress. So politicians in power right now need to recognize that the decisions they're making will have a significant impact on their children, on their grandchildren, on people alive today. And we're going to keep on making a ruckus about it until they do.
Okay, thank you. And let's see, next we have Constance in San Francisco. Constance, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And sometimes the best thing is ask an old person. And I do have solar panels, and I do ride the Muni, which is zero emission at this point. We can do better on a local level. Why doesn't San Francisco have a leaf blower ordinance? Call the Board of Supervisors. But actually, It's really individual choices can only go so far. We can recycle our butts off, ride public transportation. I buy no petrochemically derived products, only plant-based. But it's our military-industrial complex that's driving the planet into crisis and the other militaries. And we need to look at our medical-industrial complex, our military-industrial complex, and really work on a large scale. Product regulation, we can learn something from European Union, precautionary principle, where you don't put the toxic chemical out in the first place. We can look at fabric softener, but I think we need to look at our weapons testing and what our military is doing, and all countries need to do this. So thank you so much for accepting my comment.
Okay, thanks, Constance.
I'll take that. Thanks. Thanks again for that question. You know, the question of the military is something that's difficult to do and something that we must not sidestep. Our U.S. military is in over 100 countries in the world. It is perhaps the worst polluter and the largest emitter of fossil fuels and the biggest user of petroleum, and obviously defends the oil interests in all these other countries to the detriment of the people of the world. So I think that bringing that up is really important. And again, Isaac has said we can do all we can with these small, significant personal changes, but that doesn't change this system that's really hurting us all. Now, bringing this up calls into question, what is a just transition? If we really want a peacetime economy that works for all of us, we've got to provide a transition for all the people working in the military. And that's something that has to be part of a just transition.
And I'll just say that if it weren't for the U.S. military industrial complex, the refugee families that we work with would still be living on their land, living their traditional lifestyles with their people.
Okay, excellent point. So we're actually about to wrap up here. Let's see, Bruce in San Francisco, do you have a really quick question or comment?
Yes, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can.
Okay, great. So I've been working in this in the environmental movement for some time, but what did think we're really missing parts from the trees. I think globally, it's really important.
It's a little hard to hear you right now.
With local government to build like local.
Okay, Bruce, we can't hear you anymore. Oh, okay, I guess we lost Bruce. Well, in any case, the show is about to wrap up. I see we have a call from Wayne, but I think, Wayne, unfortunately, we're not going to get to you. Do you want to give all of you, want to give your websites before we close out the show? Megan, how about you go ahead? How can people find out more about APEN?
Sure. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, but I think the website is APEN4EJ.org.
And Isaac, how can people find the Sunrise Movement?
Sure, yeah, you can check out sunrisemovement.org or look us up on Facebook, Sunrise Movement Bay Area, Instagram, Twitter, we're out there.
And Martha, how can people learn more about SEIU?
Well, first of all, I would suggest go to the website for Labor Network for Sustainability. That's a collection of many union members nationwide and locally. Our Labor Rise group has a Facebook page, and I'm at marta222sbcglobal.net.
And thanks, everyone, for your called-in questions and comments, and thanks for listening to the show. If you have any feedback for me, my email is carla@kpfa.org. Thanks again, everyone.
Is our planet in hospice mode? Unembedded correspondent Dar Jamail has put himself into many of the geographical front lines of the environmental crisis, from Alaska to Australia's Great Barrier Reef to the Amazon rainforest. The End of Ice is his new book about those travels. He's accompanied on it by climate scientists and meeting everyday people whose families for centuries have fished and farmed in the places he visits. Conversing with Dar will be Antonia Juhas, a leading energy analyst and author of 3 environmental books. They'll be at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley, on Thursday, January 31st, 7:30 p.m. This KPFA benefit is wheelchair accessible. Tickets available at brownpapertickets.com and supportive indie bookstores. That's for environmentalist Dar Jamail and Antonia Yuhas, January 31.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online.